All right, I'll go ahead and get things started here so we have as much time as possible. We'd like to welcome you out to another Federalist Society event. If my count is right, I think this is number 21 for the school year. And those of you who are not familiar with Federalist Society, we are a group of libertarians and conservatives who believe in federalism, freedom, and judicial restraint. That's enough of me talking, so I don't think Professor Epstein and Professor Choper need an introduction. So Professor Epstein will speak first for approximately 30 minutes. Professor Choper will then speak for 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. So without further ado, if you'd please welcome our participants.
There's seats available up front. And why is it that they always put the microphone in a different county? So I'm going to get in front of the microphone so I can be a man of the people for once. That's not my natural inclination. Anyhow, it's a very nice pleasure to be here, and I like to thank Mr. James Phillips for his indefatigable organization, and Jesse, with whom I've sparred on more times, I guess, than we could count over the last 40-odd years that we've both been in teaching. The one thing I would note at the outset is we both started teaching at age 25, which is something that doesn't happen today, which I think is actually a mistake. I'd rather have people sink or swim in education rather than being instructed up to the gills so that by the time they're 30, they can't think for themselves. This is generally my view. Anyhow, we're supposed to talk about the Commerce Clause and bring it back to Obamacare. And I actually, when I think about this subject, find myself with a great deal of ambivalence in the way in which I talk about it. That is, I don't have much faith in all of the individual mandate arguments that have been raised with great effectiveness by Randy Barnett. If you want to be essentially mesmerized by somebody who's an extremely effective speaker on that subject, he's one of the few people in the world who can say things which others might regard as outrageous with such a reasonable tone that it turns out that he's amazingly persuasive to audiences who aren't steeped as I am in the kind of negativism associated with the modern Commerce Clause. Now, why do I use this dramatic term negativism to describe my attitude to the way in which the world comes? Because essentially, as a person who thinks about the Constitution, I'm pretty much a strong originalist on matters of structure. And when you start to take that kind of position, the odd debate is not so much whether or not you can find an exception to Wickard and Filburn and Jones and Laughlin by finding a situation in which it turns out that the government is asking people who have done nothing at all to do something. It's the question of how it is that a case like Wickard and Filburn came to be the baseline from which all of these other questions have been judged. And so what I'd like to do is to kind of go back, talk about how I think this thing ought to be structured, and then once you understand the logic of the Commerce Clause and its original incarnation, the issue of whether or not, to somebody of my particular persuasion, whether or not Obamacare is constitutional is one of the easiest questions to dispose of in the face of the earth. But that's true of virtually everything associated with the New Deal. They all go down the tubes, never to be seen again, and this is generally not something which is going to, shall we say, strike a responsive chord on the Supreme Court, which of course is all people who essentially have bought into the status quo. One of the things I think that's important about this, before I go back to the history, is that if you look at the decision in Lopez, Justice Rehnquist, who's an extremely ingenious lawyer, started off with the assumption that Wickard and Filburn is sacred ground and only tried to find a way to distinguish it with respect to what went on in Texas with the gun control law. He did not try in any way to limit it beyond, in fact, this very technical position. And what he said, in effect, is carrying a gun within 100 yards or 1,000 feet of a school doesn't alter the price or the number of goods that are shipped in interstate commerce, and so therefore it doesn't have a substantial effect. But anything else that happens since that seems to have that kind of an effect. Certainly running a comprehensive health care scheme, if what you're thinking about is whether or not it would pass muster under the Wickard and Filburn test, the answer is, I think, quite clearly yes. And I also think quite clearly that Justice Rehnquist would have voted to affirm, at least before the sort of new discourse started to come up. But let's go back to the beginning and ask what the clause actually says. This is a naive view of constitutional interpretation, which begins with the notion that you read something before you discourse about it. And what the clause, I mean, this is actually quite radical and daring these days, but I'm willing to take that on. What it says is Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations among the several states and with the Indian tribes. That's all it says. And the question is, what do we mean by commerce when it's used in that particular series? And it was pretty clear from the early days, starting with Gibbons and Ogden, that commerce essentially meant intercourse, that is, trade across state lines, and also the various means to ship goods across state lines. So it would cover interstate sales on the one hand, and it would cover contracts having to do with things like navigation, passenger trips, and so forth on the other. What it did not have anything to do with was the manufacture or production of goods within any particular state. Indeed, if he had decided that question in the opposite way in Gibbons and Ogden, the entire nation would have come apart because it would have meant that the national government would have power to regulate the operation of slavery inside the particular states. And if there's one thing that everybody was agreed upon, there was a huge amount of power to deal with the question of slavery and interstate commerce, maybe, but there certainly was none with respect to plantation activities and so forth. Now, why is it that one would want to have that particular version? Well, the sensible feature about it is this. If you're trying to figure out how it is you establish, generally speaking, competitive economies, the things that you're most worried about with respect to states is their ability to blockade the shipment of goods and services across state lines and therefore to fragment, in some powerful sense, a national market. So that if you have production that takes place in any one of anywhere from 13 to 50 states, and other states could prevent these things from going across the border, what you would do is have the same situation you had in Europe when you had the Rhine River, which was constantly blocked by people building castles here, there, and the other place. And indeed, the Treaty of Westphalia from 1648 actually was one of the great achievements in liberalization in Europe, and it was surely one of the models to which the founders looked when they started to think about how the commerce course started to work. And so their particular view was, and it was a miscalculation, that Congress would take the job in making sure that all provincial state barriers and so forth would be removed, and that the Constitution would apply only to the extent that you had a prohibition against the taxation of imports and exports between the various states. And, you know, it's not a bad design. And the theory is if you could get things into commerce from multiple states, what happens is at that particular point, competition across state lines will create a national market, and you then have to figure out how it is that states locally regulate the kinds of things that come in from overseas. And the correct answer to that is the one which is now adopted today internationally, is you have a general kind of non-discrimination provision such that the states cannot tax more heavily or more regulate more heavily those things that are coming in from outside than those things which are produced locally. And that is, in fact, a quite stable situation. And what it does is it produces a fairly vigorous kind of economy on the one hand. And what you do is you manage to avoid the risk of huge amounts of national cartelization, where the government sets a single rule for all producers or all shippers inside the particular nation. Now, it turned out it didn't work. And the reason it didn't work, for the most part, was that Congress rarely stepped in order to prevent provincial things from taking place. And so what we did is we had one of the major reversals in terms of the Constitution. Namely, we had Gibbons and Ogden, which slowly led to the position where you had the Dormant Commerce Clause jurisprudence, which put the court in the position of knocking down, unless Congress dictated otherwise, various kinds of restrictions on interstate trade. And in fact, the courts have done this rather elegantly, even though the textual authority for doing this is extraordinarily weak. But what happens then on the affirmative side? Well, we started with Gibbons, and it's a fairly narrow decision. We then fast forward to a case called E.C. Knight, which essentially did not involve the manufacture of goods, although that's what was stated. It was the question of how it is that the Commerce Clause applies to various kinds of actions under the Sherman Acts for companies that are operating in different states who seek to cartelize some form of a local market or a national market. And frankly, nobody at the beginning figured out how that would work. It doesn't involve the shipment of goods back and forth across state lines. Originally, the Supreme Court said no, but within 3 years in a case called Addison Pipe, it turned around and it said, to the extent that you're dealing with the antitrust side of this particular business, you can get federal commercial jurisdiction under the Commerce Clause. Now, how was this understood at the time, I think, is important. This past quarter, I taught a course in the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, at NYU Law School. And much to my amazement, I asked the question to myself, well, how did this thing become constitutional in 1906, given the fact that you have this megalomaniacal agency controlling every single aspect associated with the production and dissemination of goods? So what I did is I found an early treatise on the subject from 1906. And what that particular treatise said is that what Congress really had to respect the limitations imposed upon its powers by an unambiguous line of cases, so that the FDA essentially had no power to regulate the manufacture or production of goods to the extent that these drugs were made inside the states. The only places where it could regulate manufacture and production would be in the territories where it had a different head of jurisdiction, namely the ability to make all needful laws for the governance of the territories in the United States. What it did have at that particular time was the power to control the shipment of goods in interstate commerce to the extent that they still remained within their original package. And even that authority was barely sustained by a 1903 decision, which some of you may remember, called Champion and Ames, wrongly decided in my view, which said that to the extent that you had a shipment of lottery tickets in interstate commerce, when the sales were legal in the state to which they were sent and the production was legal in the state in which they were made, Congress could nonetheless prohibit their particular shipment, even though it did no harm to anything in interstate commerce, which is a marked extension from the earlier cases, which says that when you're dealing with interstate commerce, you could regulate the rails to the extent that there may be explosions that take place on trains, or there may be injuries to workers who are engaged in interstate commerce. Anybody who's looked seriously at the jurisprudence between 1900, say, and 1935, when the whole thing starts to unravel, will be impressed, not with its intellectual incoherence, but with exactly the opposite. These guys understood what the basic rules were, and the statutes that they were passed were in perfect conformity to what happened. And just as a matter of historical aside, the question is, when did the FDA start to get its power to regulate manufacture and to have a system of review of drugs that were put into the market for safety? It's not an accident. The year was 1938. And this is not done because of the scandals associated with production in one of the famous cases of the 1930s. It was because by the time 1937 and the labor cases had gone down, everybody had realized that there had been a huge transformation of the way in which the local market had operated. So then we start looking at the two major cases that sort of gave us federal jurisdiction. These are Jones and Laughlin, where the United States Supreme Court overruled the decision of three lower circuit courts, including the Second Circuit with Learned Hand, all of which held rightly in my view, still rightly in my view, that the National Labor Relations Act was unconstitutional because it sought to regulate manufacture rather than the shipment of goods in interstate commerce. And then a case called Wickard and Filburn, as you all know, which sought to regulate the ability to grow wheat in your own backyard and to feed it to your own cows. The important thing to understand about these cases is that they're not funny cases. In particular, Wickard is not a funny case. What was going on in each of them was the following kind of very powerful progressive impulse. You realize that if you wish to create an effective system of labor organizations, you're going to have some kind of monopoly power. The moment you try to do that at the state level, the migration of workers and jobs will go to other states. And so if you want to stop what maybe the unionists call the race to the bottom, either you did it as a federal matter or it was not going to work at all. And when it came to Wickard and Filburn, the feeding your grains to your own cows was simply the tag end of a very comprehensive cartelization type arrangement. In the 1930s, there were things known as the Agricultural Adjustment Acts, sort of legal horrors created under the New Deal. And what they did is they sort of allowed farmers by national vote to establish what the quotas were for the production of various kinds of goods, and then assigned to the Department of Agriculture the ability to regulate how much each farmer could produce so as to make sure that you could maintain the cartel price by preventing anybody from cheating under it. What happened in Wickard and Filburn is that a fellow who was denied the ability to sell first to the interstate market, then to the intrastate market, vertically merged. So what happens is instead of selling the things, what happens is these large farms which had wheat would sort of obtain or be bought by somebody who was making, you know, growing cows, and they'd feed it to one another so they didn't have to have a sales transaction. And this was 20% of the market, and if you did not regulate this, the cartel would again go down south. So when you start talking about why they did these things, there were very powerful reasons, and they all tie in with essentially the view of the world that was dominant under Franklin Roosevelt. Never met a cartel that I did not like, never met a monopoly that I will not strengthen, never met a barrier to entry that I will strike down. What we were trying to do was to create some model of the corporatist state in which, in effect, national governments would form sweetheart deals with unions on the one side and large corporations on the other. It is, to my mind, the worst of the possible visions you could have as to how you run a country. But Roosevelt somehow or other thought it would be just fine. And how do we know this? Because he was always against monopolies in some sense, because he was in favor of cartels. He didn't want one person to own all the dairy industry. He wanted all the farmers to get together and decide what their output and their production ought to be, which is the classic cartel definition. So these cases essentially were born in cartel heaven. Now, when you start getting to the national health care system in today's situation, you're dealing more or less with exactly the same kind of situation and the exact kind of power. If you look around in the United States system, the health care system today, by any objective standard, is a complete and unholy mess. Because what we have done, in effect, is to interlock all sorts of imperfections in terms of the way in which the system operates so that it does not operate at all well today. So people will always come up to me and say, well, how could you possibly defend the market if, in fact, you see the way in which the market operates under the healthcare system? And what you have to do is to make it very clear that what you're doing is seeing a market responding to a set of regulations. And one of the things that happen with respect to large businesses is if they are given a weird and imperfect set of incentives by the governments who control their activities, they will act in obnoxious and miserable ways. What happens, therefore, is you must be able to control the incentive structure under which these particular decisions are made in order to get anything that starts to look to be sensible. So if you go back to sort of late 2008 and early 2009, there was a threshold decision that the president had to make and that the Democratic Party had to make with its huge majorities on how they were going to push the healthcare system. And there were two positions that were taken. One of them, which occupied about 98% of the political spectrum, was that what we have to do is to handle the process of access, getting everybody into the system, but not do anything structurally in order to make sure that the system would start to work in a more coherent fashion. And then there were a few lonely voices on the other side, of which myself and David Hyman, I think, were the two major ones at this particular time, which says you get this thing exactly backwards. What you have to do is to first look at every single aspect of the current healthcare system. And the one thing we do not know, we do know for certain, is you do not need to have an extensive vision of what the Commerce Clause is like in order to deregulate at the state and at the federal level. And one of the sort of political philosophies I think that I would like to bring even to the charmed halls of Berkeley is that when you're talking about issues having to do with redistribution, the motto in all cases is summarized in two words: redistribution last. Now you say, what do I mean by that? Is this man going to be completely asocial? Does he not care about the poor and the downtrodden? No, it's exactly the opposite. What you have to do is you first figure out how to release the productive capabilities of a people so that you could start to expand the pie, lower the cost so that you can increase access without government regulation. And then after you've taken all of those efforts towards market liberalization, what left by way of need for redistribution can, A, usually be done by the private sector in a much more effective way than by the government, or if done by the government, can be done with a larger pie from which you can draw to a smaller group of the population which is going to need the aid. So you don't want to start with trying to figure out how everything is the status quo. You want to think around how it is that you're going to change this. So it doesn't take a genius at the federal level to say, look, we don't want to have all these mandates. We don't want to have all of these prohibitions on the way in which people can move from state to state in the practice of medicine. We do not want to have a situation which insurance companies cannot compete one to another. We do not want to have a situation in which only doctors can practice medicine. If Walmart knows how to do this, let them do it. And if people don't like it, let them go somewhere else for the services in question. These are not small changes. The amount of improvement in the total productive capacity of the American medical system that you could get with a certain amount of intelligence is probably 2 to 3-fold without putting a single dime into it and by withdrawing millions upon millions of dollars for direct regulation. There was a piece by a man named Atul Gawande written several months ago in The New Yorker, and Atul is a terrific novelist and a great surgeon and a great descriptive reporter and a terrible economist, because what he does, in effect, is he manages to describe conditions perfectly accurately and then miss what's to be done with respect to the errors in question. And what quite simply happens is if you describe a situation where somebody introduces a radically new way in which to provide better care at lower cost through a Medicaid system for the most indigent portions of the population, what you'd like to do is to figure out a way to give him some fraction of the gain so that he or somebody else would do that. But our current Medicare system only has this rigid formula about the way in which it reimburses reimburses, so that the higher the results you get at a global level makes absolutely no difference to the way in which your reimbursements take place. What you would like to have is higher reimbursements and profits to those people who bring down costs and extend care to everywhere else. If you can find a way in dealing with the healthcare system to increase access by lowering cost and lowering administrative cost, you do not have the problem that you have now where massive taxes on other sectors are going to have to come in and try to figure out how it is that you are going to be able to subsidize the healthcare system by distorting everything else. And so what we do is we have a series of silos, each of which is looked at in a heaven. We're going to spend a couple trillion dollars here on climate care. We're going to spend a couple trillion dollars here on re-regulating the Dodd-Frank bill. We're going to spend a couple trillion dollars in trying to figure out the health care. And where will we take the money from? Somewhere else. Where does that somewhere else be? It tends to come from welfare systems that really need the support in some cases. It tends to come out of educational systems, like, for example, that in the University of California, which is starved for funds in order to satisfy pension obligations that were created by government negotiations with collective bargaining units and so forth. So this is a very different way in which to do things. So when I start looking at this stuff, and I think about the sort of individual mandate, my reaction is this is really quite a silly little piece of legislation in many cases, but it's essentially a kind of a tag end, an unimportant detail with respect to a truly horrific system which ought to be condemned on 1,000 other grounds. What the government has said, and they're telling just about a half-truth, is that you absolutely need this sort of thing in order to make sure that individuals don't free ride on the healthcare system. But of course, they don't believe that any more than you do. One of the ways that you could stop free riding is to tell people, if you don't get healthcare insurance, we're not going to give you anything out of the public. And at that particular point, some people will bomb. But of course, they don't want to stop free riding. What they want to do is to create subsidies. Because at the same time they're calling these people free riders, they're saying, we'd like you to contribute, say, $1,000 into a system from which you will get only $200 worth of benefit. So the definition of a free rider is somebody who, in fact, is providing a subsidy to somebody else, which is the exact inverse of what's going on. And one of the reasons why the government has had so much trouble is when you start to talk out of both sides of your mouth, saying, we need you for subsidies and we have to prevent you from free riding, they don't seem to realize that the two messages are totally discordant with one another. And generally speaking, even in Jesse Chopra's rational choice, rational basis world, you cannot, in effect, put forward simultaneously flatly inconsistent rationales in order to support a single kind of procedure. So I think that, you know, at that point it's there. The second thing, of course, the government did in this case was very stupid, is they started to lie. They do this all the time in litigation, but what you do is you get it through Congress by saying it's not a tax, it's a penalty, and you do that not because you like words, but because you want to keep it out of budget calculation, you want to steer it through certain kinds of committees. Then when you get it to the courts, you say, oh, no, this was just a terrible mistake. This was really a tax, and it wasn't a penalty at all. But as a tax, it's a terrible tax, because essentially the last thing you want to do is to take some isolated group, subject them to a tax to go to somebody else. The basic rule that Epstein has with respect to redistribution, if you must do it, runs as follows. If you're going to redistribute, it must come out of general revenues. You never want to have a system where, like Leo DeRoche, you could say, let's him and you fight. A situation where the parties who are dictating the transfer payments have to pay no fraction of the money in question. It leads to a massive form of political responsibility and systematically to overtaxation. So when you start looking at this particular bill, well, no matter how you slice the details, and if we had more time, I would go into it, every single sound principle of economic accounting and of medical rationality is violated up and down the line over and over again in ways which bear no relationship to the constitutional issues. So how then does this particular political debate start to turn out? Well, surrealistically, as far as I'm concerned, all the people who are in favor of it come forward with a perfectly plausible statement if Wicked and Filburn is true. And they start to say, look, this is the biggest industry in the United States. If you're telling us that we could pull a single thread out of that thing, look at it in isolation, say, we don't like that particular thread, and assume that the rest of the structure comes down, what sort of madmen judges do you turn out to be? And my attitude to them is, you're right. And then there are the other guys who come back, and they say, look, if you have all of this particular power, and the only way that you could contrive to get this thing through Congress is to take a step which is so dubious in its origins and so questionable in terms of its effect, this is absolutely outrageous. And I look at them, you're right too. So you now have the situation. Which set of hypocrisies, which set of mistakes, which set of intellectual blunders do you wish to deal with most? Do you want to seriously question the foundations of this whole thing under Wicked and Filburn? I think the answer before the current Supreme Court is no. I mean, I've heard Nino Scalia say so many times that he's a faint-hearted originalist who knows that too much water has gone over the dam for him to change things, so they're not going to do it. But this is the way I would put the argument if I were on that side. Look, you guys have gone this far, and you've made a mess of everything that you've managed to touch. Now you're trying to go one step further. We may not be able to pull back on Wicked and Filburn, but we certainly ought to be able to tell you that the decisions that you've made with that as the basis of American constitutional law are sufficiently dubious and catastrophic in their consequences that we're not going to go a step further. Will they say that? Not on your life. Because essentially what they have to do then is to talk about the wisdom of the legislation that came forward, where the entire premise of every discussion under the Commerce Clause was wisdom is something for the Congress, it's us only to determine the scope of the Constitution. And sometimes when you hear them, you can see them cheering in the background for the statutes which they are trying to disown in this particular way. One of the striking things, for example, about the United States against Darby, which was one of the cases which upheld the minimum wage, was that Justice Stone, who wrote that opinion, was basically saying, it's not for us to decide the wisdom of this wonderful statute, which is going to protect all of these workers from various kinds of oppression. It goes on like that all the time. In fact, I'm now involved in a case involving the takings type issues where what the government says on the one thing, look, it's not for you to decide the wisdom of the exchange regulation that takes place. This is a matter of economic liberties, minimal due process is all that's required. We obviously passed that. Look at Senator Durbin and everything else like that. And so they say, don't merit the merits. Then when we try to go for a preliminary injunction, they say, this wonderful statute essentially requires immediate implementation or otherwise the system will fall to pieces. This is a system that's growing at 20% per year, but that's a different kind of story. So what you do, in effect, with respect to this is you have to make do with something which I hate to talk about in connection with modern American constitutional law. And this is what I call the theory of the second best. Now, for those of you who turn out to be economists, the second best has one very clear meaning. It refers to those types of situations where do is you know that you have one perturbation inside an economic system and no further that if you keep everything else in exactly the same place that it would have been if your equilibrium were purely in competitive firms, a competitive ideal, you don't know whether you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. And so it's extremely difficult when you have errors in one part of an economic system to know what sort of adjustments you make in the other. What you ought to learn from that is make as few mistakes as possible in order to avoid having to make all of these corrective actions. When you're dealing with constitutional law, the single hardest feature to deal with is what I call the reconciliation of the original with the prescriptive constitution. And by the original constitution, I mean what any fair-minded, objective reader would take of a particular clause, understanding the historical context in which it was written and the sort of the philosophical tradition under which great texts were interpreted at the time of the founding. And so they were basically very heavily influenced by the classical Roman tradition, which is a very part of my life, and you can see it all over in that place. And so you've got to get it right. And under that version, it's quite clear that the Commerce Clause is construed through about 1935. Was more or less correct. And everything after that is just a huge fall over the wrong side of a cliff. Then, on the other hand, you have the prescriptive constitution, which is some of these mistakes have gone on for so long that it becomes impossible to entangle them. And just as we say the continuation of a wrong in property law leads to the perfection of title by the passage of time, that's what we mean by prescription or adverse possession, maybe that's going to happen here. The difficulty is we never know when we want to play one game or the other. With respect to the Commerce Clause, there's a large enough set of sentiments against me. I did not come to this room announcing that I'm a member of the intellectual mainstream of the Democratic Party, after all, who wants to keep the status quo. But when it came to cases like Plessy and Ferguson, you know, generally speaking, the fact that it was 58 years on the books when Brown v. Board was around, this is the way people argue. They did not say, this tradition has been sanctified by 58 years of continuous uses and constant support by the United States Supreme Court and all lower courts on the importance of anti-miscegenation laws. They said, this has been 58 years of a national shame. And they were right in terms of the way in which they wanted to deal with that thing. So you have to decide which way it's going to go. My guess is I think, in effect, the statute will be upheld. And I think it will be held on grounds that are rather disingenuous by a series of judges who don't want to contemplate what I regard to be the rather messy origins of the modern constitutional jurisprudence. If you look at the academics on this particular court, none of them are what I would call particularly adventurous in terms of their willingness to blow things up, as certain people in this room are. And then on the other hand, when you look at other people, they're completely comfortable with this because they were in Congress. They would have lobbied for the bill and they would have voted for it. And they would think it's an absolutely wonderful thing. Why would they want to turn the world upside down? I don't know what the vote will be. I don't know whether it will be 5-4 or 6-3. There's even a chance that Justice Kennedy may wake up on the wrong side of the bed or the right side of the bed and decide to go with the other four and strike it down. But if I was a betting man, I would probably say that it's about 80-20. At which point, the issue will not be resolved. You're going to have 1,000 kinds of appropriation questions that you're going to have to fight. You're going to have massive resistance from the states on the way in which this thing is going to be implemented. You're going to have huge numbers of government waivers. And you'll have a system which is in total collapse, even though it has a perfect constitutional pedigree. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go up here. I got notes. So, I want to say it's always a treat for me to, Richard used the word spar, to spar with Richard Epstein on constitutional issues. But I always feel that when they, when it was announced I had 10 to 15 minutes, that they ought to measure this thing not by the minutes, but by the word. And that at least gives you know somebody a fighting chance under the circumstances. So let me begin by this, by saying, I'm surprised. I guess I was surprised by the presentation because I came here. I came up expecting two major arguments. One is that the mandate. What is it? The individual mandate that you require someone to do something is unconstitutional. That's the major argument that's been used by the lower courts that have struck it down, and I thought, at least by those who were challenging it, you would argue the substantive due process right not to have to do something.
No
so,
time.
Pardon me?
No time.
No time, okay. that was something that I think I could talk more easily about. Nonetheless, I want to be clear. The last thing I want to do is get into a discussion of what is the best policy way to handle the healthcare problem. That's not what I'm talking about. I don't think it's it's not what I'm talking about. But that's there. But I am not someone who wants to say it's a wonderful statute. I don't think that those people who voted for it thought it was a wonderful statute. It is obviously, by virtually unanimous agreement, a flawed statute. The notion was, get it up there and fix it up. Get it up there while you still have the votes. Okay. So let me go on to the constitutionality of this. Interestingly enough, Richard says, he doesn't want to dispute that under existing doctrine, the healthcare, the individual mandate, which is what's under challenge in the courts, is okay. That's not very difficult to sustain that. Well, that takes away a lot of what I was going to say. He goes on to say that this is not part of the original understanding. And one thing I would differ with is that there is someone on the Supreme Court who takes your view, and that's Justice Thomas, who wrote a long opinion in the Gun-Free School Zones Act case, saying that the purpose of the Commerce Clause was to grant only the interstate part of it, stuff traveling from one state to another, transactions, or the actual transfer of goods and so forth doesn't apply to agriculture, and it certainly doesn't apply to someone buying, I guess, health care. But health care, as I think about it, I don't want to comment on whether you could try to push it under that or not. And Richard, quite candidly concedes that he's talking about something that would invalidate, I don't know about the whole New Deal, but enough of it, enough of the whole New Deal. Well, that's a large point. Let me say this. He argues original understanding. And I must say, I certainly agree with what he said was, and this is the key word, part of the original understanding. I don't pretend to be someone who has studied the history of any of these things with any great care, like anybody else who's in the field. I read it. I come to the conclusion that you can't prove very much specifically about the history in many, most cases, I believe. And even when you do sometimes, it interferes with certain other judicial values, not policy values, at the time. But I'll just leave it that vague for the time being. But I just don't think that you can stop with saying that the original intent was, as Justice Thomas argues, doesn't apply to things that go on wholly within the borders of a single state, but it has to cross state lines. Interestingly, Richard argued that one of the big purposes was to give Congress the power to remove impediments imposed by, erected by states, if you will, to a national economy, which was true. I think that was a major reason. But I think even the originalists would take the view that there was more to it, that the provisions of the Virginia Plan were carried over into the Constitution. Even, I would say, in this generation of constitutional historians, Jack Rakoff at Stanford takes the view that as a matter of original understanding, the notion that the power of Congress was to extend to national matters over which the states were incompetent to deal. And the economists, they got a word for that now, collective action problems. And there's an awful lot of talk about that, but I've always believed that if there were a judicial criterion to enforce the limitation on congressional power versus states' rights, it would be that criterion. I myself don't believe there ought to be, that's another matter, any judicial review of questions of the scope of national power versus states' rights because, among a number of reasons, states are very well represented in Congress and they don't need the Supreme Court to come to their defense. But put that aside, it seems to me, for example, that the court could well have taken the Gun-Free School Zones Act and said that this is not an issue in which the states are incompetent to deal with the problem of guns in, they didn't much care if they were near schools, they cared if they were in schools, and all of the resources that would have to be spent to take care of that sort of thing. So, the proof is in the pudding. I forget how many states, I think over 20 states, had laws, just like Congress passed in the Federal Gun-Free School Zones Act, and although as I would have said that it's non-justiciable, nonetheless, if you had to have a criterion to strike something down, I would have agreed with that. But this healthcare issue is not a question in which the states are competent to deal. They are separately incompetent to deal with it. There is a collective action problem involved for a number of reasons. The most obvious is that if a state were to undertake the expense of enacting one of these statutes, it would be costly economically, would therefore make their system less competitive in that particular way. Anyone who lives in California knows that is one of the great political issues in this state, and that is we have made a state, the state of California, through its various systems of regulations and taxes, inhospitable to business and so forth and so on, and we're not getting any. Whether that's true or not, I'm sure there's some truth to that sort of thing. But how much true It is, doesn't make any difference. The fact is that there is such a problem, that you economically disadvantage a state that on its own is going to undertake an individual mandate. And unless the argument is that a state couldn't do that either because it violates the Due Process Clause, which is certainly quite a stretch under existing doctrine, and it seems to me more than that, it's antithetical to a basic position of judicial modesty and restraining the power of judges to make that argument. This is what I was, you know, prepared to spend some time on. But assuming that the states could do it themselves, and indeed, Massachusetts, I think, has it today. What is less known, under, as everyone knows, Governor Romney proposed a plan, you know, similar, I don't want to say the same, but similar to this. They're living with it. How well? No one knows. But Kentucky enacted one and gave it up after a very short period of time. Why? A couple of insurance companies left the state, it became very unpopular. Why? They didn't want to be there by themselves. It's like minimum wage laws. If you one state has a substantial deterrent from enacting a minimum wage law because you raise the cost of goods, you raise the cost of doing business, you make your goods more competitive. Indeed, not only do you have difficulty selling them across state lines, you have difficulty selling them in your own state because the more cheaply produced goods from someplace else, look, you all know more about economics than I do. It's a pretty simple proposition, but we see it all the time at a national level in which low costs of doing business take business away from this country, so low costs, higher costs of business someplace else in one state is going to disadvantage that state. The other is, usually I'm not a big believer in this as a practical matter, but I am so far as the healthcare is concerned, is that people are going to have a powerful incentive to move to those states we'll give you health care of one sort or another, and if other states don't do it. And other states aren't going to do it. They haven't done it, very many, on their own, because they're hesitant to do so. So I guess for those reasons, it seems to me that even under the original understanding, this is a classic illustration of a situation, and no one disputes the fact that this matter has a substantial effect on interstate commerce. That if you took seriously the notion, or even not very seriously the notion, that something that goes on within the borders of a single state but has ramifications in other states is within the commerce power. And I mean, that's why I would find, forget Wickard, you can overrule Wickard, although I forget Wickard against Filburn. I mean, this to me is powerful in respect to that particular principle, and I would be surprised if, I don't know about surprise, this court surprises you periodically, but I would not be surprised if they got as many 7 or more votes to uphold this provision when it gets to the Supreme Court, 7 or more votes. My assignment was to talk about 10 minutes or so, and I guess yours was to listen, and I hope we finished about the same time. Okay, thanks a lot.
Sure, and then if you want to...
the microphone up there.
Here you go.
Well, come sit back here. let me just make a couple of comments. One of them about the collective action problem. The problem with a collective action problem is you don't know the sign to attach to it unless you know the context. Competition is a collective action problem for all the parties who are engaged in it. And the solution to a collective action problem is known as a cartel. The reason we don't like this particular solution to a collective action problem is because the systematic externalities outweigh the gains to the parties to the system. So just because you show this does not mean that you've shown anything of consequence at all. And to go back, this argument was in fact made very ably, the argument that Jesse made, by none other than John W. Davis when he was an assistant attorney general for the United States in a case called Hammond and Degenhardt, where the issue that you had to face was whether or not the Congress could say that you are not allowed to ship in interstate commerce any goods that were made with child labor where the children involved were under 14 years of age. And what you did is you had a state, North Carolina, which had a 12-year child labor law. And what Davis said was exactly what Jesse said. Hey, if you allow this stuff, there's going to be a race to the bottom. You're going to get these states doing these terrible things. We've got to boost this stuff up. And this is what the Supreme Court said. First of all, they said, is this an effort to sort of regulate local manufacture? And the answer is, if you understand the thing, surely yes. The ability to employ child labor in your business or any affiliated business is certainly worth something to you, but your ability to reach national markets is worth a great deal more. Anybody and everybody will surrender the one right in order to gain the other right. And so essentially you would have the forbidden kind of regulation. But the other point is, who are we to say that 14 years is better than 12 years with respect to child labor? This statute was, in fact, struck down, rightly in my view. I thought Justice Day had it on the head. And as usual, when this Holmes is in dissent, he's always wrong. And this is no exception to it. And what do we do? You look at the history of child labor in the United States, both before the decision and after the decision, it was consistently going down. Just as the number of hours that were being worked was consistently going down. And this is at a time when maximum hours laws were unconstitutional. The simple truth about this is collective action problems, which essentially make competition impossible, ought to be struck, ought to be encouraged. Collective action problems that facilitate competition ought to be encouraged. And so the whole point of the federalist system was to try to create open arteries for commerce going back and forth, and then allowing for competition to take place on all of these dimensions. So what I think, in effect, is that what he describes as the cure is, in fact, the problem. We would do much better off having states constantly trying to figure out ways in which they could make themselves more attractive to business. And it's a situation when one does it, the others feel necessary to follow. By the time you're done, you'll have an expanded pie with a smaller set of health problems. Every time you engage in redistribution, every time you engage in mandates, you engage in the destruction of wealth. And when there's less that you have to go around, somebody's going to be hurt. There's never been a good, long, sustained argument for shrinking pies on the grounds that you or I or those people in Congress actually know how to cut the slices such that when you associate the utilities with the particular wealth, you will get more utility out of a smaller pie. You want to talk about a mug's game? That's the one to play, and that's the one that the Congress has been doing for years. This is not meant to be a criticism only of Democrats. You take the Republicans and farm subsidies and things like that, and they too should be made to walk the plank. Do you have anything to
come? Yeah, I mean, I can answer very simply. It may well be true that the better policy way of approaching this is by stopping federal regulation. I'm no great fan of federal regulation. I don't want you to misunderstand that. Indeed, I'm no fan of state regulation. Not to say that, but that is not the issue. The issue is what is constitutional or not. And in my judgment, whether or not Congress chooses the right way or the wrong way to deal with a matter that appears to it that the states are separately incompetent to deal is up to Congress. And therefore, the court, and as a matter of original intent, it seems to me that that is true. Whether or not, I mean, you could get economists here, we can debate this for the next 2 years. As to which is the best way to deal with problems like this. But that's what we have the democratic process for. Yep.
that allows factions to dominate. What happens is there's a profound difference. The New Deal, summarized in a single sentence, is the choice between competition and monopoly as a political matter to be decided first by the central government and then by the states. The classical liberal tradition of which I'm a part says, nope, the presumption is always in favor of competition, never in favor of this, and the government has to have a very powerful showing to explain why it is it's going to regulate. So the whole point about constitutions is to stop democratic processes, not to essentially flatter them. And if you give them the right constitutional constraints, they'll actually do something useful from time to time, like revising the UCC or improving the recordation system. But I think we should probably open this up. Somebody? Some shot. Oh, yes, you, sir. Stand up and so we can see you.
Thank you for your presentation. That was excellent. My question is about the future of federalism. So if there is, after this case, let's say it's decided in favor of the government, is there probably isn't any room left where the state and the federal government don't share much jurisdiction, and you can attack that point. But my question is this necessarily such a bad thing policy-wise? Because if we want to improve healthcare, one of the ways we could go about it is with a national regulation. We could have federal laws that preempt this patchwork of individual state regulatory schemes that might actually foster competition in the long run. So is this such a bad thing?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to preempt. The one thing in which preemption works, I think, extremely well is, in fact, with respect to the federal preemption of state tort actions for medical malpractice and product liability, particularly for people who manage to sell products that comply with FDA regulations. And the reason I think you have to do that preemption is because otherwise the state systems will go crazy, and the reason they'll go crazy is because we've already given up on freedom of contract as a serious impediment, right, with respect to the ways in which state regulates, so that what you do is you have state trial lawyers coming in, getting massive kinds of benefits from their state, bringing these suits, and Justice Stevens say, I hear no evil, I see no evil, I understand no evil, and therefore assuming that the strong presumption will be against preemption. So oddly enough, after you flip this over, the Santa Fe and Rice case, which is the one which sort of announced the presumption against preemption, may in fact be wrong. But in a first best universe, you would not want this. But essentially, the moment you have concurrent jurisdiction over all types of issues, you do have to worry about the situation in which the more severe regulator will always win. Particularly, for example, take minimum wages. Federal government says, California, you want to raise those things? Be my guess, right? And so this state, with its own peculiar internal constitution, manages to always make a bad thing worse. And you're seeing the consequences of it now.
Well, I got to repeat the same thing. This time I'll quote Holmes, even in dissent. He was in dissent in the Lochner case. I'll paraphrase it. You know, he would have said today, look, the Constitution did not enact the Chicago School of Economic Theory. That may be right. And I know, and listen, Holmes was a social and economic conservative.
Actually, he was a nihilist. No. I mean, it's interesting.
Well, what is it?
No, let me just, on the Holmes thing, let me just mention one little point, then we'll take a question. Is when he got to write Abrams, the cynicism could have said, gee, I don't know what the hell, in a democracy you want to suppress dissent, that's fine by me, the dominant forces. But he wrote the most stirring opinion, and this time he got it right. When times has come to many fighting phase, you have to let them go. And even with the classical economics, I mean, one of the things that, just intellectually in my own life, is that you discover that the number of pure competitive markets that you could find out there is a rather bit smaller than the ones that you had previously believed. And if you go back, for example, to the period between 1880 and, say, 1930, the greatest intellectual achievement of the Supreme Court was in what area, do you think? I'll give you mine.
The application of the Bill of Rights to the states.
No. Trivials. They were terrific at rate regulation for complex industries. Those guys really.
What period are you talking 1880, about?
1930.
Oh, I got the wrong thing.
Yeah, I mean, because the incorporation only began with Gitlow in 26. Yeah. These guys were great regulators. I mean, to understand. And they were pretty good on antitrust law. In fact, the average quality of their opinions in both those areas where market failures took place is far higher than it is today in the United States Supreme Court, which doesn't dirty itself with such hands, such questions like that. Sir?
Yeah. So I think that you've mischaracterized the healthcare market as a whole in terms of, like, it is actually possible to have a true competitive market within healthcare. In comparison comparison, like if I was buying an iPad, I don't actually die if I don't get an iPad. Many people think they may. But
you have a competitive market in debt?
But you can't have a truly market competitive, because people are going to get insurance. It's an inelastic demand. They need it. They need care. Somebody's going to have to provide it, unless you're willing to let them die in the hospital.
Well, no, I mean, look, I think that's wildly over the top. I mean, one of the things that's so odd about it is that if you assume that the only mode that you could have is sort of individual health care acquired at the time of crisis where demand is highly inelastic, yes. But one of the things, for example, that John Cochran and I myself, he's another Chicago economist, is that one of the ways you deal with the pre-existing condition problems through market solution is that when people buy insurance at your age, they buy it in two components, one for the current risk and the other which insures them against they have of guaranteed coverage in the event that something goes wrong. Now, why is that insurance not sold? Well, the answer is that it's not legal. And why is it not legal? The answer is long-term health care contracts are not enforceable in the United States, so all the people who find themselves in the good state of the world come the second period dump the contract, which means there's nobody to fund the other risk. And that's just one illustration of how it is that if you let put people to work, you could do this thing in a perfectly coherent and sensible fashion. This is not a coherent market today, but you've got 47 different state mandates or more in the state of Illinois, all which require you to buy things that you don't want and make it impossible to buy the things that you do want. You've got a situation now where, in fact, the number of people who have employer-based insurance is down from about 60% to 50%, and it's all a function of direct state regulation. You have a president who never found a mandate that he didn't like. Anything that he's going to be imposed, this is the definition you're working on. The definition of a market failure is it doesn't require people to buy something that costs it more for them to take than it's worth. And if you just got rid of these mandates and watch what happened to the price and the nature of the coverages, I think you'd see a very different kind of story.
I'll depart from the constitutional end for a moment. I wonder what would happen if there were one or two states in which you were, if not governor, king, and you impose these things. My guess is that collective action problems would end it very, very quickly. Now, I'm not saying that a state shouldn't do this. I'm a big believer in the notion that states are, that the smaller the level of government, in most instances, that's better. But it seems to me that that was not the original understanding at a broad level. And that's where I think you look to the original understanding, not whether prayer in the schools is all right or something like that. But the notion was give Congress the power to produce a national solution when the states seem to be failing at it because they're incompetent. I like that. Those were the words of the Virginia plan.
I don't think there's a shred of textual historical evidence for that particular position. What I do think, in effect, is that the way in which they had a means for this, which is if you could keep the arteries of exchange open across state boundary lines, then competitive forces would start to take over. The difficulty with the original constitutional scheme is it originally won, and I think this was true when you looked at the original version as it's drafted of the 14th Amendment, is it was clear that they left too much discretion to state power, not in terms of its ability to control jurisdictional issues, but because there wasn't a sufficient protection of individual rights. The only way that the federal government could interfere with the states at that point was the Contracts Clause. And if you go back and you read the literal meaning of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, it's a complete revolution. I mean, and the Slaughterhouse cases, when it says that, first of all, we define everyone who's a citizen, and we say no state shall make or enforce both levels any law that abridges the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States or of the several states. What they're doing, in effect, is taking all the classical English liberties, all of which are, shall we say, part of the laissez-faire Chicago or classical liberal constitution, and saying the solemn job of the federal government is to impose those restrictions upon the state. And it was that which I think made our friend Justice Miller gag. He could not believe that it was that transformative, but it was. So essentially, after the Civil War, we had a government at both levels with fewer rights and fewer powers over individuals than before, which to my mind is exactly the right way you want it. So Justice Holmes talking about shibboleths and Herbert Spencer, he should have only been as enlightened as Herbert Spencer was.
Do you believe that the Privileges and Immunities Clause forbids the states from enacting individual mandates?
Our privileges and immunities? Do I believe that? In terms of the traditional accounts of the police power, I think the answer is yes. I think that the basic rule is the one that I put forward. There's a kind of an interesting contrast here. It was very clear historically that nobody wanted the federal government to be in the business of welfare redistribution across state lines. If you go back and you read Catherine Drinker Bowen's book on the Miracle of Philadelphia, she talks about this issue in one sentence. All questions of welfare are left to the states. When you then incorporate the takings clause, which is an anti-redistributivist clause, it would really shatter that particular understanding, and I think probably not wisely to do so. So I think, in effect, that the original understanding was that states are in charge of welfare, but I think, in effect, that the minimum condition for welfare is the one that I stated, which is that you must fund transfer payments to selected groups out of general revenues. You can never pick a particular targeted group to pay another particular targeted group for what's going on because of the real dangers of factions associated with it. So if you could get redistribution through that, it's fine. And that's essentially was the position that, if you remember, Justice Scalia took in his dissent in San Jose against Pinel. He said, you want to run a rent control system? Rent the units from the private owners at market rates and give it out to your favorite tenants at below market rates.
Suppose Congress passed the following tax. It is a general tax on everybody, but you get a credit for the first time you buy health insurance policies.
That's a nice question under those sorts of things. If, in fact, the credit is going to be dollar for dollar for the amount of money that would otherwise come out of the fund.
More or less.
Yeah, then I think it's
dollar for dollar for what you pay.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's terrific. And, you know, the area where it's really needed is somebody passes a statute which says whatever you're paying by way of real estate taxes now to support schools, which are in designated funds, you get a dollar for dollar reduction for any time you spend it on private education. Now, there's progressivity.
Do you believe that Congress could effectively accomplish what it seeks to do with the individual mandate by that statute?
I think it could. As I said, remember what I said about all of this is that, remember, I talked out of both sides of my mouth, you recall, right? On the current law. And I said on the other
side. I didn't say that.
I did. I said it when I gave it. I mean, I said, you're right and you're right too, right? And essentially, the argument that the strongest argument from the antis. Is there 1,000 ways that you can do it? Professor Chofer has now told you 3 or 4 of them. And of all the gin joints, you happen to go into this one where it can't be done. Sorry, there's no romance. Go back and start over again. And all revenue bills begin in the House of Representatives, and we know what's going to happen to this one when it goes there. In fact, that's what I would do if I were the Supreme Court. You want to know what this Solomon would do? I do not take care of politics. I think this is a crappy funding situation, but it's too important a piece of legislation to simply strike down. If these guys can fund it through a legitimate type tax, it would be fine. And therefore, go back. We'll suspend the failure of this thing for a year. But of course, at this point, everybody knows who's running the Congress, right? So, I mean, this is no surprise. Eric Cantor will not salvage, as is Speaker of the House, or rather the majority leader, what's going on there. Noah Boehner.
Well, I guess I think that it is largely, I mean, when you say the House is Republican now and they wouldn't pass it, that is somewhat instrumental, I think, in the theory. You don't want to say that.
No, I'm saying.
I think that's form over substance. First of all, if I had your view, I would say, no, that's not a tax, it's a regulation. Because A, it's a regulation. It's not going to raise any net revenue because you got to give it back as soon as you buy the health care policy. And secondly, it's coercive. Who in their right mind, if they could get the health care policy? And there may be some, you know, individualists who feel that, you know, they don't want to touch government at all and so forth and so on, and they won't do it. But most people could fall right into line. They buy it in a New York minute.
No. So, what they do is they buy whatever it is, these private Medicare plans. That should be just wonderful if we can do it. Of course, the Obama people hate all that stuff.
They can buy any Medicare plan they want.
That's what we want.
Medical plan that they want.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, my view is that the plan they should have enacted was the Mitch Daniels plan. That actually has redistribution in it.
What was that?
His plan is, look, we want you to know here's $3,000 that everybody gets. And if you don't spend it on health care, you keep it. Then we've got a next layer, and it turns out up to, say, $10,000, you have to pay half. You'll still be a little careful. Got a catastrophic risk, we pick up 100% of it. And then everything else is done privately. the level. I mean, do you understand how these medical loss ratios work? Are you aware of the peculiar interactions between federal and state government, four levels of review on 5,000 plans, all of which has to be done within a 90-day period by a bunch of people who don't know how to count to 10?
I'm not happy about those things.
Oh, I mean, they're crazy. Anyhow, we'll take. When do we end this?
I think we should end it right here.
Oh, I'd
like to thank our producer.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Jesse.